I'm Daniel Atlin. Welcome to Messy, where I have conversations with leaders about how they navigate and make sense of the mess they find themselves in. Do leaders really matter? In a messy, complex world, especially in organizations that serve the public good, the answer isn't always clear. That's what we explore on Messy. Each episode, I talk to leaders from around the world about how they navigate politics, manage competing stakeholders, and keep things moving when the challenges never stop. You'll hear their lived experiences, their mistakes, and the strategies they use to survive and thrive. I'm Daniel Atlin, and after 30 years working in higher education, government, and social purpose organization, I've seen how messy and difficult, but important, leadership really is. And I'm very pleased to introduce our guest today, Diana Beach. I had the good fortune to connect with Diana over a coffee in London this past June and was absolutely captivated by her interesting background, seemingly boundless energy and passion for policy and higher education. Diana joined City St. George University of London in April 2025 as director of the Finsbury Institute, the university's new public policy hub, and she also serves as Assistant Vice President, Policy and Government Affairs. Diana holds a PhD in German Studies from the University of Cambridge and has had several senior leadership and policy roles in higher education and within national government. Thanks for joining me for this conversation, Diana.
Thanks for having me, Daniel.
Now, I didn't go over your bio in detail, but I also thought it would be much more interesting if you spoke about your own journey yourself. It's what I call a little bit of retrospective sense-making. I'm truly fascinated by your journey, and in some ways, we actually have parallels in our journeys as well. As you've shared with me before, you've got an interesting career that spans academia, government, an industry trade association, and a couple of universities. Would you like to talk about your journey on the planet so far and how it's prepared you for working in complex and messy organizations?
So I suppose it's worth starting by saying that my journey on this planet so far hasn't exactly taken the simplest or the most logical of routes, but I guess that's why you've invited me on a podcast series called Messy. So I'm going to give it a go to make sense of it for you. I guess I've always thought of my career as having been determined by a mixture of luck and me grabbing opportunities that have come my way. But also, I guess there's my own determination as well to make the most of these opportunities, because I realise I've really had some one-of-a-kind positions, so I've never been complacent about them and I've always been keen to see what I can do with them. So let me explain what I mean by that and take you on a brief canter through my career to date, and I'll try to make sense of it along the way. So first off, I should say that I never expected or even thought about going into policy of any kind when I started out. I started off life in academia, I went straight through from my undergrad studies to my master's and my PhD. And then I was lucky to get three successive postdoctoral research positions. The first in Canada at the University of British Columbia, then in Germany at the Technical University of Berlin, and then finally back in Cambridge where I did my PhD as well. And it was this last position that I really call my transition moment or my career epiphany, if you like, because what I did was I answered a call, which was looking for a researcher to investigate the values driving European science at the time. Now, before I got to this point, I can honestly say that I'd never given a thought to how science policy works. But hey, look, I got the job. I started work on the project and I was hooked. Within weeks, I found myself going to Brussels. I was talking to policymakers from the European Commission and lots of different member states. And I suppose I just got bitten by the bug. I realised very quickly that there's a world out there waiting for insights and expertise, and that you really do have an opportunity to make an impact quickly, and certainly more quickly than academia sometimes. So it's at that point that I really made that conscious jump to pursue a career in policy. But I should say for everyone listening as well that it wasn't easy at the start either. I think just as early career academics can lament the fact that they have quite precarious employment terms, you know, short-term contracts, living hand-to-mouth on research grants, it was really the same for me when I moved into policy at the start as well, because I really found myself repeating that postdocing experience again. But this time I had to build up that portfolio in policy through research, through influencing, through advocacy, through lobbying.
It sounds like a variation on what we now call a gig economy. And we certainly see the same with part-time or partial load faculty. That must have been really tough. So how did you manage it?
So I'll spare you the details, but I had quite a few short-term contracts. I worked in a research consultancy. I worked as in a research position and a trade body, looking at labour market trends. And then finally, I moved into government, where I got a position in the Department for Education, project managing the establishment of the Office for Students, the new sector regulator in England at the time. And I suppose that took me back into my happy place, back into higher education and research, where I started. And it was from there that I got my big break as the first director of policy and advocacy at HEPI, the Higher Education Policy Institute, which is the UK's only independent think tank exclusively devoted to higher education. And honestly, that was such a fab job. I got to immerse myself in all the big issues of the day. And one of the reports that I ended up writing, probably about 2 years into that job, ended up on the desk of the Universities and Science Minister at the time. He invited me in, and to cut a long story short, he offered me a job as his advisor. I mean, you can't get much better than that. And that's what I mean, is really having had those one-off opportunities that you just can't plan for. And I'll always be grateful for those.
Timing is everything, isn't it, Diana? And from personal experience, I can say that working for a cabinet minister itself is like an applied master's of public policy. And you were a public policy advisor at a very unprecedented time.
So yeah, I ended up serving 3 or 4 different universities ministers, depending on how you count them, because that was the time of the Brexit shenanigans here in the UK. And I had one minister return to post. But it gave me a real insight into how Whitehall works. It gave me an idea of working with different personalities and also in times of turbulence in politics. And that really set me up to go into my next stage of the career, which is the one I'm in at the moment. And that's working in my sector with universities and using my knowledge of the political environment to advocate really for the sector that I love. And I've done that in a couple of places. I had a brief 1 year job at the University of Warwick when they were experimenting having eyes and ears on the ground in Whitehall in London. But then COVID hit during that job. So there was no one on the streets of London. I then was lucky to get a job as CEO of London Higher, which is the representative body for over 50 universities and higher education institutions in the UK capital. And that's a job that I held for the past 5 years until this spring, when I decided to step down and take up my current opportunity at City St George's University of London. And as you said at the start, I now have the very exciting task of setting up a brand new policy institute in its School of Policy and Global Affairs. So yeah, I guess I've now come full circle. I'm back in academia again. I just took a very roundabout way of getting there.
I think I said to you beforehand that we can only make sense of, I think, our careers actually by looking backwards and retrospectively, because I don't think you could actually engineer some of these things, you know, along the way. They are in some ways organic and a mixture of serendipity and perhaps some false turns, but also circumstance too. So thanks so much for sharing that. Now, as you said, you're basically running in some ways an academic startup as the inaugural head of the Finsbury Institute. What's that like? And what's it like coming in and building something from scratch? And how do you go about that and making the connections? And maybe talk to me about your biggest surprise along the way.
I mean, look, I'm not going to lie. It's daunting. There's not a day goes by without me feeling the weight of expectation that's on me to create something successful. Not only because of my past career successes, I was lucky to turn London Higher around in my last job, but you know, the financial climate for universities in the UK is quite precarious at the moment. And so I'm always aware that the university is taking a risk by investing in this initiative. And so I've got to get it right and I've got to deliver for them. That said, the weight of expectation aside, it is an enormous privilege to be entrusted with the task of building this institute. And it's been really fascinating for me over the past few months just to learn what everyone is up to inside the corridors of the university. I know I'm not going to be short of experience to showcase to the world when we finally get going properly. In terms of coming to something from scratch, I really do think it's liberating because there is no blueprint to follow. In my last job, I came to the job of CEO 20 years into the organisation's history. And so I found I spent quite a lot of time wondering why things were as they were and why it wasn't so easy to shift perceptions. But I don't have that with this job as I'm starting from scratch. So this gives me much more freedom to shape something from the outset. But it also means that every decision I take matters, from shaping the vision of the Institute to carving out our niche in the wider policy landscape. I have to get it right. And in terms of the biggest surprise for me, I suppose it's been how quickly people have actually rallied around the idea. I think it's no secret that the higher education sector isn't really known for embracing change. I've been warned time and time again that universities can be quite, you know, change averse. But actually, since I've been doing this job, I've been struck by the appetite for fresh thinking and the willingness of colleagues, both within City St George's, but beyond as well, to support something new. I think it's really reminded me that there's a willingness to innovate in the sector, but sometimes, you know, it just needs that spark. It needs someone to get it going. It needs that space to breathe, and it needs the right people to believe in it. And I'm proud to be part of that process, actually.
Well, that's just a wonderful sort of framing, actually, I think, of the opportunity and challenges you're facing as well. And you're right. You know, it used to be that universities had trouble innovating and changing. I think now we're actually seeing a new era where people are looking at different ways of running organizations. And there's a little bit, I think, of an inflection point where people are actually looking to evolve in different ways. And I think that's very, very exciting. Now, what's it like actually being a non-academic, you know, stepping into this role? How do you build actually trust and credibility that way?
I think we're all academics at heart, and I think there are lots of ways to get to this position. I would be my first critic in many ways. I'll always say, well, I'm not a proper academic. But, you know, when you think about it, I don't want to get too philosophical. What is a proper academic? There's lots of different routes to get in there. You could do it through the research and publication route. You could do it through the teaching route, or you can do it through that professional practice route. And I'm probably, even though I started out with research, I'm probably the latter. You know, I can bring all that policy experience to the table. I do think it gives you a special vantage point. You can kind of see things differently. You've got the freedom to question why things as they are as they are. And that's really important when you're trying to do sort of an innovative project, as I am. But that doesn't mean you've hit the nail on the head, that you don't need to win trust first. That can be difficult. You don't want to be seen as the outsider coming in, telling people what to do, and I've got this big idea and you're going to do it. Universities are full of clever people. They're full of egos, rightly so. You can't just impose something on them. So actually, it's all about relationships. And that's something that I think my past experience in policy has helped me learn very, very well. I've worked with all kinds of people, not just, you know, politicians and universities, but within that, all the different kind of people that power those organisations. And they all need different approaches. You need to know what drives them, what pulls them, what levers you need to avoid, what you can pull. And it's knowing that and knowing how to handle people, I think, that you can slowly try and socialise your ideas and win them over.
That's a great philosophy, I think. You know, how to bring people along, how to engage people resonates with me, because when I first started in academia or working for academic institutions, I always felt like I am not worthy. And actually, sometimes I said that actually to people in not that language, but different ways. Let me help you be successful. What can I do to help you? Right. So I think sometimes actually that can be very disarming as well by respecting people and actually, you know, admitting actually what your starting point is. You've got a very interesting vantage point and a view from the higher education in the UK. And I think in many ways, the UK is leading, I think, the world in some ways about the different forms of radical collaboration that's happening and different solutions, different ways. What's your view actually on the situation, the immense, I think, propensity for change and different policy things that are happening and the opportunities that are also facing, you know, institutions in the future?
So let me take a step back for a moment. I know that UK universities are hitting the headlines at the moment as a result of their precarious financial situation. Their costs are increasing as the real terms value of the funding they receive is declining. And something needs to change quickly before an institution topples. That's certainly the narrative that's out there at the moment. But I think we need to unpick that a little bit. I don't see the financial crisis as the challenge facing universities, but I see it as the result or a symptom of a far wider challenge, actually. And that is that universities have maybe lost their legitimacy and their relevance with society. I think over the past few years in particular, a lot of scepticism has slowly crept in about the value and the purpose of universities. Are they representing value for money? Are they out of touch with the communities around them? Are they stifling free speech? Are they teaching the skills that employers need? Are they being led and governed effectively? I could go on. I don't think any of these issues are unique to UK universities in particular. But what we've done here is we've let them mount up and we haven't really been good at countering any of them. We haven't got an answer for any of these questions. So I think what we've ended up in is a situation where the public is at best ambivalent about universities, and the government, and that's irrespective of who leads it, it's not about politics, they just don't see any point in wasting any political capital in trying to help them when there are other things that the public cares about them. And if they deal with those other things, then they win votes. That's the currency of government. So really, we've got to win back the public trust and support first, because if we don't get that right, then we're not going to get the political help we need to get us out of our financial doldrums. Now, I know that seems all doom and gloom, but I do think there are opportunities in that too. I think the inflection point that you've just mentioned that we're at, it does present a chance for institutions to rethink what they're doing, to rethink their mode of operation, to redefine their core mission, and to articulate what they do best to society. This might mean doubling down on what their local region, their civic region needs, that sort of notion of a civic university. Or it might mean thinking about forming alliances and consolidations in the sector that can enhance opportunities and research potential. And that's something we've certainly seen hit the news this week in the UK with the proposed super university between Kent and Greenwich. Now, there's no one size fits all for the sector. I'm not saying that model will work everywhere, but we've got to try it. And I think whatever the solution is for those individual institutions, the ones that are trying something and the ones that can show they can refocus strategically and to communicate their value clearly, they're the ones that are going to have much more chance of getting public support and standing out in the crowd in what is really a contentious policy landscape at the moment.
Absolutely. It's true. I think you describe actually an environment in a context that's very similar to Canada as well. And I think with a little bit of variation, similar to other Commonwealth countries like New Zealand and Australia, we're all facing this broader context where the universities are not, as I'd say, seen as partners to governments and delivering their economic and you know, social benefits that they used to be. I think there's a lot of questions, and sometimes actually there's a lot of people, I think, who actually like to beat up universities and see that there's actually votes in beating up universities. And that's very troubling, especially from vantage point here, where we're seeing south of the border in the United States, that's happening on a regular basis. So very much of a challenge. But this also means, I think, in a lot of ways that your work is cut out for you. You have lots of work in the public policy, but also in the broader sector. You know, we're seeing, you know, initiatives announced every day. You wrote a really great paper, I think, with Andre Spicer, Dean of Bayes, about unboxing higher education, different opportunities, actually, that they can face. So how do you actually keep going, despite all the noise that you're feeling, despite the fact that you're pulled in all these different directions? What keeps you going?
Oh, that's a good question. It's something I don't think I've ever thought about. I suppose it sounds corny, but it's the love of my sector. Higher education changed my life. I wouldn't be here talking to you today if I hadn't gone to university and stayed at university. But it got me to where I am today. And I want that to continue for other people, and particularly those who never dreamt of going to university. I want to show it's there for them. And to do that, I've got to make sure that universities stay standing. So I see it pretty much as a moral calling, but it's also something that I know something about, and it excites me. So I'm very happy to do it. I don't think about it as a job. And even with the new policy institute that I'm setting up, I really see the two-way opportunity, because yes, we can put university research out there in a way that maybe it isn't resonating with the outside world, and it can help policymakers with the solutions to some of our societal challenges. But also it gives universities a chance to show, actually, we're listening to you as well out there. We hear your concerns, and we're using that in turn to shape our research and our focus and what we're looking at. So we're not an ivory tower that's impenetrable. We're open, and there's this two-way flow of information. So that's the end state that I'm hoping to achieve.
That's wonderful. And that passion comes out, I think, in all your approaches and your conversations and every engagement. As I said, you're very busy, I think, in actually, you know, commenting on the state of the system and on different events and things like that. And I think it's great to hear that you're always focused on trying to make universities, I think, more relevant to society and to the communities they serve as well. So can understand how that passion could actually, you know, buoy you and keep you focused. So maybe we can actually turn to you know, slightly different part of your identity, because we think our jobs, you know, become so much of our identity. And you know, oftentimes we're defined by that. In fact, oftentimes when you go to a party, you know, people ask, the first thing they ask you is, what do you do? What do you do? Where do you work? You know, I think, though, that it's important to recognize, and as leaders especially, you bring all your identities to work. So do you want to actually, you know, talk to me a little bit about all the different identities you have or the different parts of it? And what do you do sometimes to escape actually your role as, you know, being so immersed in higher education?
I'm laughing to myself because I absolutely hate that question when somebody asks me, what is it you do? Because whenever I say I work in policy, I inevitably get those blank looks going, what's policy? And then I find myself looking blankly back going, I don't know. It's that influencing thing. You know, I haven't got a definition for what I do. So I like to try and avoid that. It's normally something vague, like I work in a university, full stop, which I know does a disservice to the job, but it's a lot clearer to understand. So yeah, in terms of identities, I have a few in higher education. I mean, self-confessed policy wonk, I suppose, for want of a better term. I comment on developments because I think it's important that, you know, we have that sort of culture of instant reaction and make sense of what's going on. But I also like to think I do the thinking behind that as well. It's not just commentary, but there's substance. And so I do like working on fresh ideas and the thought leadership for the sector as well. And thank you for mentioning my recent report with Andre Spicer, which was an example of that, published by HEPI earlier this year. I'm also a governor in a university. I'm coming into my ninth and final year, I can't believe it, at the University of Worcester, which is a very much a regional university in the West Midlands area of the UK. And it's my local university. I never went there, but it's the university on the doorstep of the place that I grew up. And it's my way of saying thank you to that new institution that has really changed hearts and minds and brought opportunities to a local region where there isn't much opportunity without it. So that for me is all part of my civic duty. But it's not all about higher education, you'll be pleased to know. I do like to switch off as well. And it's not much, but, you know, I do like to carve out a few evenings a week so I can go to the gym. For me, doing exercise is a real de-stressor. I put some good music on, I work up a sweat and I forget about the world for a bit. So I do switch off there. I also think it's really important to have some plans. I love travelling, for example. I don't do as much of it as I would like to, but I do always like to have something to look forward to now. So, you know, we're heading into the winter season. I studied German. I like to have a Christmas market to look forward to at Advent. So that will be my focus. Once I've got that, then it'll be an Easter trip and a summer vacation as well. So I always think it's really important to have that light at the end of the tunnel, because when you're in the thick of it, you need something to get you through it.
Absolutely. I think we all need those things to focus a little bit of light on the horizon, a little bit of a time to sort of escape the roles and the everyday sort of drudgery or routine that we're in. I know you went on a very interesting cruise, actually, I think this summer, the nice summer cruise that you met, I think, all sorts of interesting weather. So that probably gave you a little bit of a different sort of vacation as well.
I did. A big shout out to Norway. I went all the way up the coast of Norway to the Arctic Circle, the very northern tip of Europe, which was, you know, great. It's not something that you do every day. So I really, really enjoyed it. But unfortunately, the weather wasn't on our side. So I did get a lot of rain. So for a Brit, escaping rainy UK for a rainy Norway wasn't exactly an ideal summer vacation. But the scenery was stunning. So win-win.
Now, so we often hear, you know, on podcasts like these or in conversations about people moving from success to success. And you didn't, you weren't actually, I think, promoting, you know, and bragging about your failures too. I actually love the idea of actually a failure CV, and I've actually drawn out mine before as well, which talks about things that I didn't achieve, you know, learned from as well. Do you have a story of a failure or a mistake that you'd like to share, and maybe what you learned from it or what you thought about it from the distance now?
I know I've just given you a bit of a whirlwind tour through my CV, but you might recall that I mentioned I was a program manager. Well, that was a job that wasn't for me. I realised very quickly when I started it, and I was surrounded by spreadsheets and critical path documents and all those technical things, that it really didn't play to my strengths and I just wasn't interested in it. While I was busy having to track project timelines and progress charts, I really was looking to the people over in the corner having those policy discussions, thinking, that's where I want to be and I'll be much better at it. But the effect of that was that I saw myself becoming quite reserved in that job, and I became demoralised, and to the extent that I lost quite a lot of confidence and I didn't recognise myself. And even my friends and family were commenting, like, where's your energy gone? You know, you're not Diana. So I knew I needed to do something about it before it was too late, and it took its toll on my mental health, to put it bluntly. Thankfully, I have a success story. I was lucky. I got a policy role at the amazing Happy. I loved the job and I recovered. But I realise now, looking back on it, that it could have easily gone the other way if I'd been too shy or too proud to do anything about it. I was brave at the time. I gave up a job and not having anything to go to. But I knew I had to get myself out of it before it was too late. And I'm flagging that because I don't think there's any shame. I don't want anyone to ever feel any shame if they're in that situation. I think it's just as important in this life to learn maybe what you're not good at or what you don't enjoy, just as it is all the positive stuff. And you're right, we'll talk about the positive stuff, but we kind of gloss over that we're maybe not so proud of. Well, we do need to take a little bit more ownership and have some courage to talk about it, because, you know, it could make a difference for somebody else, maybe a bit younger in their career or lower sort of down the line. And you don't want them stuck in a career that they're not going to thrive in.
Absolutely. Well said. And I think you're absolutely right. We also expect, I think, sometimes that success to be, you know, instantaneous and overnight, when sometimes actually, you know, it can be very circuitous and take a while. And sometimes there's actually some missteps along the way as well. So I think we really need to actually, you know, focus on that. And, you know, so much is depending on colleagues. It depends on circumstance. It depends on context as well. Something that could be, you know, very successful, you know, at a certain point in time, you know, may not be successful, you know, due to other circumstances and vice versa as well. I think we have to look at everything, you know, from that lens too, especially in a sector that oftentimes doesn't reward risk-taking, and you get punished either by governors, by perhaps, you know, senates and academic bodies or by broader community as well. We have to be able to, I think, you know, look at that sort of risk appetite and make it a little bit better.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, I love people, but at the same time, people can be the biggest downfall to some of the projects if you don't bring them on side. And if I may just add just another example of something that I consider a failure, I pride myself on those personal relationships. And so when I don't manage to connect with people in the way that I'd like or I expect, I take that personally. And that's something that I found happens quite a lot in academia, because I find people hear what I've done in the past. I worked with perhaps a government that they didn't like, or they see me as supporting the interests of vice chancellors and management. So they automatically, you know, put up the defences, they put up barriers towards me. And I find that sad. Despite all my commentary, if you look at what I say, I've never taken any open political positions in favour of one side or the other. I do what I do for the love of the sector, but sadly, not everyone sees it that way. So I guess I've had to learn the hard way that I'm not always going to get everyone on side, and you've got to just develop that resilience to get through it.
Absolutely. You have to develop that resilience to get through it. And I think you have to realise that everyone makes assumptions. We all, that's a human nature, is to make assumptions about people when they enter the room, and based on their appearances or based on their backgrounds. And we always have to keep those in check as well. I do find that a great way to perhaps get at some of those questions, some of those issues that come out when people are perhaps somewhat adversarial or have an opinion of you, is to actually just become a person who asks questions, ask questions and get their why are they like that? Why do they think that? What are their expectations? And I think that can sometimes disarm people too. What advice do you have for people who are considering a leadership role in a university or maybe with the government or another complex purpose-based organization?
My advice would be to lead with purpose and not position. I've said before that complex organisations like universities, they're full of clever people. So that means leadership can't just be about authority or pulling rank, because everybody is going to be the same, if not higher than you. So what you need is to have empathy and vision and compassion. You really need to be comfortable navigating ambiguity, balancing different competing priorities, and making decisions that serve not just your interests, but the institution of those and those of the wider community as well. And indeed for universities, the wider public good. I think you need to surround yourself with people who think differently, and don't be afraid to do that. You need to challenge yourself. And as you just said, don't be afraid to ask questions, because questions are really going to help you unpick those assumptions and move forward. And then I think finally, I have to say that you've got to remember that leadership is relational. You've got to build trust, you've got to actively listen to people, and you've got to make sure that you're communicating clearly in a way that resonates for them. And that's not one size fits all, that's communicating for different stakeholder groups. I think some of the most impactful leaders I've seen in my career are those that really actively empower others, that give others opportunity, they foster collaboration, and they create those spaces for innovation and ideas to thrive. It's not always easy to do, particularly in complex organisations, but it's incredibly rewarding when it does happen. So I think perseverance is key.
Thanks so much for that, Diane. I know you've given us great advice on trying to navigate the mess of leadership. And it is messy. It is messy at these organizations. It's messy at all every organization. But I do think that organizations like government or universities do take the cake. So really appreciate your thoughts on that. Any parting thoughts you have about the mess of leadership and what you like want to share?
I think you're doing exceptional work with these podcasts, because I probably sat in my corner of the world in the UK thinking, oh, what a stupid career I've had. I can't make sense of it. But actually, by reaching out and connecting, you're finding more of us out there. And we've got that kind of, I'm not going to say self-help group, but we've got that kind of solidarity and camaraderie where we can share ideas and hopefully, you know, keep that positivity up for the future as well.
I kind of like that. It's a community of messy practice, or a messy community of practice, perhaps. Well, thanks so much. I know you're likely busy and probably, you know, have a bunch more meetings to go to, but I really appreciate your sharing your view of a messy world and how you actually, you know, personally make sense of it as well. So thanks so much, Diana. I think you can tell that I really enjoyed this conversation with Diana. Her positivity and energy is contagious. And I think what I appreciated most is her drive and passion and her recognition that the fact that leadership is relational and that we have to build trust. Her phrase, lead with purpose, not position, has been a consistent theme of my messy conversations, as well as that need to listen and be empathetic, as it's all about people. I also appreciated Diana's offering a window into the UK higher education system. And if misery loves company, people in other jurisdictions like Canada or in Australia should appreciate Diana's insights as well. So that's it. Another episode of Messy with Danielle Atlin wrapped up. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, please subscribe and share with a friend. As Diana said, maybe we're building up a bit of a like-minded people group trying to make sense of the mess of leadership.